This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For 6 years, Syria has been involved in a civil war that has completely destroyed large portions of the country. Big cities and small towns have been reduced to rubble as the conflict rages on. Hundreds of thousands have died. Millions of refugees have been created. It is the deadliest conflict so far in this young century. Until President Trump decided to send 59 missiles into the airbase that allegedly launched a chemical attack by the Assad regime on civilians, including children, our participation was basically confined to fighting ISIS, which has taken advantage of the conflict to build strongholds there. Most of us have been casual observers to this human tragedy, seeing short clips of the suffering on TV news. But as President Trump weighs his future options, we wanted to get a clearer understanding of what's going on in Syria and on its impact on the people and the region. We will meet a Syrian refugee a bit later in the program. First, we're joined by Dr. Charles Kurzman, professor of sociology at UNC Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. He's in our studio with Dr. John Cox, associate professor of international studies and director of the UNC Charlotte Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for being.
Good to see you. This is all part of a program that happens throughout the day today, but tonight at 6:30 at UNC Charlotte Center City, they'll be doing a program as part of their Witness in Residence initiative with one of our guests today. Zubair Rushk will be there along with Amira Elamri to talk about Syria and their experience. That's tonight at 6:30. It's free. It's open to the public. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Let me begin with you, Dr. Kurzman. You say that this conflict in Syria grew out of the Arab Spring. Remind us what gave rise to what many hope would be the renaissance of the Arab world.
Yes, so the Arab Spring, these uprisings that emerged in the end of 2010 and the beginning of 2011 were such a hopeful time. The feeling was that a region of the world that had had dictatorships for so long was now finally going to have people power movements that would bring in democracy, and in fact did bring in democratic institutions in a number of places. Most of those uprisings have been pushed back and reversed in country after country. In Syria, they never managed to topple the longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad, who inherited the presidency of the country from his father. And so there became a stalemate, a civil war between the pro-democratic revolution there and the forces of the government.
He faced election at least twice that I know of. And the last time he was elected, he didn't win 100% of the vote, but it was a pretty high percentage of the vote. How does that work? Because we see this in country after country after country where we are told that it's a sham and that people didn't really vote the way they voted, or they vote because they feel they have to. How did it work?
Democracy is such a global norm that even dictators feel they have to go through the motions occasionally. And so they hold an election, they allow no opposition, and the entire country is expected to vote for the current leader.
The civil war over there in Syria has been raging for 6 years. So let's go back to the beginning. How did it start? How did it turn into a civil war? It didn't start as a war.
No, it started as nonviolent protest. Actually, the spark there was a group of school children in a southern city in Syria called Daraa, who wrote some graffiti on a wall that was calling for freedom and democracy in the same way that people have been calling for freedom and democracy in Egypt and elsewhere.
I was told that the phrase they wrote on the wall was, "It's your turn, doctor," a reference to Assad, who is an ophthalmologist.
Yes, actually, he was an ophthalmologist in London, practicing in London, and was not going to be the successor to his father.
And "it's your turn, doctor" means you're the next dictator to topple. Is that what it means?
It does. It also sounds like somebody in a waiting room, a doctor's waiting room, perhaps. They held some protests and they used "the dictatorship must fall" slogans that have been heard in Egypt and elsewhere around the Arab world.
That happened in March of 2011. And if you believe CNN, some people do, some people don't. That happened in March of 2011. And in that same month and into April, Assad responded. He didn't just ignore this. Although those kids were arrested and there was a crackdown, as I understand it, the Syrian government announced several plans to appease citizens. They got an immediate government workers got an immediate salary increase. Then later in that month, Assad addressed the nation in a 45-minute televised speech in which he didn't admit that he had done anything wrong particularly, but he acknowledged that the government had not met the people's needs. And then in April, he lifted the country's 48-year-old state of emergency and abolished higher state security court and issued a decree regulating the right to peaceful protest as one of the basic human rights guaranteed by the Syrian constitution. That sounds like, if not appeasement, at least he's moving in the right direction. They didn't see it that way?
No, those were concessions on paper only. And the next protests that tried to take advantage of these newfound rights were brutally put down. The protesters were arrested, as usual, sent off to prisons where they were badly, badly treated. There was the use of live fire and ammunition on peaceful protesters. Mm-hmm. They were headed for a serious collision. These pro-democracy activists were not getting any headway in actually making serious institutional reforms there.
Let's talk about the Assads for just a second, because as you say, Bashar al-Assad was trained as an ophthalmologist. He had an older brother who was being groomed to be the king who died, I believe, in an automobile accident or something. He died prematurely. And then his father, Fasad al-Assad, died. And he inherited the role of the leader of the country. What was
Hafez?
What was Hafez al-Assad's modus operandi? What was he like?
He's one of the most brutal dictators of the late 20th century. Had no qualms establishing multiple security forces that spied on each other and made sure that they were all oppressing the population as fervently as he demanded. This is a really, you know, if you have lists or somehow rank repressive regimes, this would be way up there.
So when his son came to power, his son who had lived in the West and who was married to somebody who was a UK citizen, was there hope that that would moderate, that he would have learned something from the democracies of the West and
yes.
brought in a new...
Yes, this is now about 15 years ago, and the idea, the thought was that this, even though it's an inherited presidency, which mm-hmm. is a sort of strange phenomenon itself, that he was going to be opening up the system and allowing more popular public participation.
Did he initially?
No.
He never
there
did.
Was, in fact, his first moves were to try to consolidate his own position
right.
because he was perceived as being weak. He didn't have the personal strength and personal loyalties that his father did or that his older brother had. And so he relied on the same group of people who had been running all the security forces for all those years.
This is going to sound like a very politically incorrect question. But is there a reason, perhaps, for a dictatorship to exist in a country in that part of the world? We saw when we went into Iraq and deposed Saddam Hussein, that the thing just kind of fell apart, that he was a strong man, he was a brutal dictator, he ruled with an iron fist, but maybe that was necessary to keep this cobbled together nation together. Is that necessary in places like that?
I would say necessary for whom? The people who
well,
were there.
To keep the peace and to keep the country a nation.
The people who there wanted democracy.
So okay.
There was a clear, widespread support for democracy at that point. They have a country that was basically built by the French and the British in collusion, cutting up the former Ottoman Empire during and after World War I. So it's not an ancient set of boundaries with
well,
ancient identity.
That's part of the reason for that question, because
right?
colonialism and the setting up of these nation states by the French and the British and now us these are not natural nations. These did not grow out of tribal customs. I mean, they're different tribes and different nationalities involved in all of this.
Well, no nation is a natural nation. They're always amalgams. They always involve multiple identities, and their national identity has to be built. There is a Syrian national identity. It's a very strong national identity among large parts, although not all, of the population. And there's a considerable amount of interaction. People lived together for decades. There was intermarriage among different sectarian groups. The sense from the scale of the protests was that people wanted this dictatorship to be gone and to run their own affairs in some sort of more democratic way. And they certainly did not want to have these human rights abuses that were so widespread at that, under the Assad regime.
What kind of an influence, if any, has Bashar al-Assad's wife had on how he operates and how the country operates? None at all?
None, I don't think. I don't think there's been this is a regime that is based on coercion primarily, and also based on a cult of personality, where they his father had his poster plastered everywhere, and everybody was supposed to sing poems to him in school, and they've transferred that now to the son. So this idea of trying to build an intense personal loyalty to the ruler. It's pretty old school.
Prior to the civil war and some of the atrocities that have been perpetrated on the people of Syria by the leadership of Syria, how would you describe, where would you rank the Assad regime in terms of dictatorship and being tightly controlling the society in relation to other countries in that part of the world or elsewhere for that matter?
Yeah, no, they were up there as among the most repressive, the most totalitarian. It spies everywhere. Popular culture was monitored for loyalty. There's an intense ideological indoctrination of children. It was pretty poor. So pretty much the large parts of the population had reason to hate the regime. And that's what we saw emerging in 2011. Was not just one revolution, the pro-democracy revolution, but then a succession of revolutions. So you have an Islamic revolution. He had repressed Islamic movements, and you have an Islamic revolution to create an Islamic state emerges, one of the branches of al-Qaeda in Syria, which came to be called Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front. Emerges. That's a separate revolution. And then you get an ethnic revolution of the Kurdish population, which is predominant in the northeast right. part of the country, speaks a separate language. They had been repressed. Our guest, Mr. Rush, will speak to some of that experience. And then you have another revolution coming in from Iraq, another Islamic revolution, another affiliate of al-Qaeda in Iraq comes and fights the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria and takes over the city of Raqqa. Four separate revolutions going on at the same time in this relatively small country.
So if Assad were to say, okay, let's have an election, a free and open election. You can vote for whomever you want. I'll step down if I lose. We'll turn it over to somebody else. Could that actually happen? If he did that, would it actually happen, or would it just dissolve into chaos?
At this point, it's hard to see how all these pieces can be stitched back together. The violence, the dislocation has been so huge. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see how that would happen, at least in the short run. But back in 2011, back in 2012, it could have happened. There could have been then a coalition of pro-democracy forces that would have stepped in, that would have, under international supervision, held elections and create some sort of coalition government. The Islamic forces would have had to have been present, but they would have been seen as the spoilers. And I think most Syrians at that point would have turned against them. Now, this deep into the war with this many casualties, it's hard to see that happen.
Dr. Charles Kurzman is from UNC Chapel Hill. He's co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Goodwill Industries at the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training job seekers, and offering health care and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. And Novant Health's Heart and Vascular Institute, providing treatment and solutions to help keep hearts beating strong. Information at novanthealth.org/hearthealth. The series of shootings by police of citizens around the country has received a lot of public attention, and for good reason, but often the officers involved have been publicly shamed, indeed vilified, whether or not the shooting turns out to be warranted. But one Georgia police officer decided to let the public in on the officer's side of the story by producing a documentary, and that officer joins us to share the perspective of the police tomorrow on this program at 9.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point on Tax Day, we'll look at what a Trump tax overhaul could look like for the country and for you. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That conversation coming up on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Syria. We'll meet a Syrian refugee and get his take on the country and his personal experiences in that country, which include being jailed by the Assad regime for a portion of time. In a moment, we're talking right now to Dr. Charles Kurzman, professor of sociology at UNC Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. Just so that we don't sit back fat, dumb, and happy here and just go, well, look at how messed things are, how great we are and how messed up things are over there. We're responsible for this. The West is responsible for this because of the period of colonialism and because of the fact that the West constantly props up dictators for our own political self-interest. How big a role does that play in all of this?
Well, the West created Syria as a country and many of the borders in the region, carving up the former Ottoman Empire. The Assad regime has not relied heavily on the United States. Their main sponsor was the Soviet Union and then post-Soviet Russia. But our support for Saddam Hussein next door, on and off, and for other dictators in the region has generated a fair bit of antipathy towards the United States.
And is this why you say that in post-colonial countries that uprisings and unrest are not unusual because they're trying to find their own equilibrium? Is that essentially what's going on
here? Well, there's been periodic demands for freedom and liberty in the Middle East just as in other parts of the world. And I don't think we should treat that region as separate or somehow less deserving or less desirous of freedom. There have been revolutions since the late 19th and early 20th centuries for democracy in Syria and in throughout the Arab world.
Are the people of Syria – I know that they want democracy. That's what they're fighting for. They want a voice in their own destiny. Are they equipped? Are they ready? Could they govern themselves without this – and stay together without this strong man at the top?
That's one of the questions that Syrians and many other aspiring democracies debate amongst themselves. It's not as though we're out here in the outside being the only ones who are skeptical and questioning. But the general answer to that is that new democracies are never equipped. They have to build democracy through practice. That takes time. There are conflicts. And yet if you come through successfully through that process, the benefits are so obvious to everyone, including to Syrians who want to be able to have the opportunity to go through that path and to have that learning experience.
When you look at what Bashar al-Assad has done to Syria in his attempt to retain power, the destruction, wholesale destruction of major cities and villages and the genocide he's committing on his own people, you wonder why anyone supports him at all. Who are the loyalists and why are they loyal?
There's a segment of the population that is affiliated with the regime through their sectarian identities. It's an Alawite sect of Islam, part of the broad family of Shia sects. They worry that, especially now that there's been so much violence, that there'll be retribution against them if these various revolutions succeed. There are also other populations who feel that they don't want to cast their lot with these revolutionary movements. So there is a segment of the population that remains loyal to Assad.
But help me out here because there are these different sects of Islam that we have to understand if we want to really get a handle on this. This is a majority Sunni country. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the sect that you just referred to, how do they fit into that picture?
They've lived there for centuries and centuries, and they there used to be control certain geographic areas. There's been more mixing in the modern era, including intermarriage between the Alawites and
Sunnis. As it was in Iraq prior to
absolutely, absolutely. And at the same time, you have these sectarian sort of entrepreneurs who are trying to generate distrust and hate in order to build their own bases within each of these communities.
How religious is Syria, because Iran is run by the Grand Ayatollah, the supreme leader. It is a religious nation. Is this a religious nation, or is Islam a portion of just a portion of what goes on in Syria?
It's a portion of what goes on, and even among the people who are considerably devout, many of them are pro-democracy as well. We have survey evidence from around the region that there are, it's not an either-or secular versus religious, but with among the seculars folks, among the religious folks, many of them are pro-democracy and some are anti-democracy.
Dr. John Cox is also with us. He's an associate professor of international studies at UNC Charlotte and at the Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies. He's with us. The people who have been most affected by the violence in Syria are those who are now refugees and those living in these towns that have been reduced to rubble. Are they just innocent bystanders, or were they actively against the Assad regime?
Yeah, a very large majority are innocent bystanders. And of course, they include some people. I don't know the percentages of people who fought against Assad. So at any rate, there are a total of 12 or 13 million displaced people. And this is in a country that numbered about 23 million at the beginning of the war. So 5 to 6 or 6.5 million people have fled the country, and there are an additional 6 or 7 million people internally displaced.
When you look at on television at the news reports of these cities that have been destroyed, it mm-hmm. looks to me it looks worse than what we saw mm-hmm. in Germany at the end of World War II after the Allied bombing.
There are a lot of parallels, and I happen to be a German historian and a historian of the Holocaust, and mm-hmm. I've also seen things and even some of the numbers. In fact, this is the end of World War II is what. You'll often hear it said that the Syrian refugee crisis is the biggest since the end of World mm-hmm. War II, which is true. And in fact, at the end of World War II, there were actually 15 million people put to flight, even at the end of the war. This refugee crisis, in terms of percentage of the population, is bigger than that, substantially bigger than that, bigger than the partition of India and Pakistan. And so, but also, I thought of something else when you were speaking with Dr. Kurtzman about the prospects for the near future in the Middle East, which is that if you looked around Germany and Europe in 1945, you would have to come to the conclusion that there was no hope for Europe. Mm-hmm. That is, you would have to say these people have been fighting and killing each other for 24 centuries, at least since the Peloponnesian Wars. So what hope is there for democracy or stability? And so I just say that because I often hear it said that from a kind of impressionistic outside view that there's not much hope for the Middle East or for the so-called Muslim world, a strange term.
But is there much hope for the existence of Syria going forward?
That's a tougher one.
how large a portion of the country, seriously, mm-hmm. has been either damaged or destroyed by the military activity? How large a portion of the population has mm-hmm. been displaced and would certainly not turn back to Assad for his warm embrace?
Right.
How large a portion of the country does that entail?
Well, it entails more than half the country in terms of people, and I'm not absolutely sure in terms of geography. And to some degree, it's a regional problem, as the end of World War II was. So, I admit we've all been talking about what the prospects are in Syria, and it's very unpredictable. And I think it's tied to also to regional solutions. As Dr. Kurtzman said, too, we've also had the Arab Spring that erupted 6.5 years ago in Tunisia and then spread quickly, mm-hmm. did some things that none of us could have imagined. None of us foresaw Mubarak being chased from power so quickly. So at any rate, that's just to say that right now it's hard to see a peaceful, just solution in the immediate future in Syria. But it's also very difficult to predict how things are going to, you know, evolve.
This has, as you say, created the largest humanitarian crisis and refugee crisis since World War II. Mm-hmm. Prior to President Trump's executive order and during the Obama presidency, mm-hmm. we did not take in very many refugees.
That's correct.
How many have we taken in, and why so few, given the nature of the crisis?
Yeah. The United States has taken in only approximately 10,000, and about 85% of those only came in the last year of the Obama administration. So for the first 4.5 years of the war, Obama brought in about 1,400, fewer than one per day. So there was nothing generous about that. It should also be known, especially sometimes because of some of the rhetoric and hysteria that we hear in this country, that the United States is hardly being flooded by refugees or from immigrants from anywhere. And in fact, as is always the case with refugee crises, the large majority are in other poor countries. In fact, 90% of all the world's refugees are in nearby countries that are usually ill-equipped to, to host them or serve them. So anyway, of these 5, 6 million or so who've been who've fled Syria, more than 2 million are in Turkey. More than 1 million are in Lebanon, which constitutes 20 to 30% of the inhabitants of Lebanon, and 600,000 are in Jordan. And again, at present, only 10,000 in the United States.
What about Germany?
In Germany, about 800,000 were brought in the last year or so.
These obviously the refugees who are fleeing the military violence don't want to head toward Damascus and Assad. Right. But if they did, what would their treatment be?
It would be in line with what how they've been treated for 45 years by the Assad regime. And certainly anyone, as we can hear from our guest, you know, shortly, anyone who's suspected of having been a dissident or an opponent is in for harsh treatment, to say the very least. But also, I've got a couple statistics here just about the extent of the violence. Within Syria, 95% of people lack adequate health care, 70% lack regular access to clean water. Approximately 400,000 people have been killed, including tens of thousands of children. Also, of the refugees, about 60% of them are children. And for example, say of the 10,000 who've come to the United States. Occasionally, the image, for example, the terribly sad and tragic image of Aylan Kurdi about 3 years ago, who washed ashore in Turkey, temporarily stirred the hearts of a few people. But you asked earlier, why haven't more refugees come in? And there's no question to me that, frankly, it's because of xenophobia and Islamophobia. And again, as a Holocaust historian, I have to see some sad and appalling parallels with the way the Jewish refugees were regarded in the 1930s.
You are, as you've alluded to, the director of the UNC Charlotte Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies. The New York Times reports that 3 tons of captured Syrian government documents record war crimes that they describe as graphic, immediate, and overwhelming. 400,000 people have been killed, half the country's population displaced, chemical weapons used against citizens more than once. Is this just war or is this genocide? And is it genocide against a sect of people, a nationality of people, or just people who don't agree with the dictator?
Yeah. Well, I'd say two things. One is that we don't always have to label every terrible crime a genocide. Some of the worst, most appalling, horrific, and large-scale crimes in history don't necessarily fit into most definitions of genocide. Having said that, I think that there are strong cases that have been made that there are – that one could say there's genocidal violence being committed against political groups. Also, some of the groups that are fighting in Syria, such as ISIS, have been – some persuasive reports have been put out, for example, by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum – charging genocide with ISIS's treatment of Yazidis and other religious minorities, which also reminds us of something that should be known to our listeners and to others, which is that the victims of so-called Islamist terrorism, groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda, are Muslims. More than 90% of the victims of these groups are Muslims, which has historically always been the case. That is, they see people who they call apostates who do not follow their interpretation as being their chief enemy.
You and others have talked about this and made comparisons to what happened with the Jews during and after World War II, but particularly during when they were trying to flee Hitler, and how the United States did not take many in.
That's
one of the black marks, I suppose, on our history. Did we not learn from our history?
No.
Why not?
In fact, there are a lot of black marks and a lot of things that we should have learned. And I'd say again, I'd say in large part because of the xenophobia, racism, and Islamophobia that prevails today. And also because we learn from the Holocaust like we learn from other things as a society, a few superficial things. A few days from now is Yom HaShoah, which is Holocaust Memorial Day, April 24th. There will be some nice events, as there should be around the country. People will get together and solemnly say, never again. And then but that occasion won't necessarily really force us to look in the mirror and to confront forms of bigotry that are right in our midst, whether it's against queer and trans people, whether it's against Latinos, whether it's against immigrants, and whether it's against Muslims. So incredibly enough, in the 1930s, one would hear from right-wing politicians like Charles Lindbergh or Father Coughlin on the radio and many other politicians that not only are the Jews trying to bring an alien culture, a strange language, Yiddish, German, etc., they're not Christian, etc., but also they may even be agents of Hitler. That is, German Jews could be agents of Hitler or fifth columnists, to use a term that had just recently been coined. That was actually often heard in the late 1930s in the U.S., even after Kristallnacht, which brought attention to American citizens about the extent of violence against Jews in Germany and Austria. And so today I think it's no less absurd to say that people fleeing this horrible violence and carnage in Syria, that they may be agents of ISIS, et cetera. Also, and again, we'll hear more from our guest, but we hear that refugees are not being vetted. In fact, they are being extremely well vetted, I think overly vetted. Your listeners can Google up an article by Natasha Hall that was in the Washington Post on February 1st. It's called something like, I know that people are vetted because I vetted them. And then she goes on to describe the extensive process. And she also talks about the potential consequences of things like the January 27th travel ban, which was articulated, by the way, on another Holocaust Memorial Day, a rather grotesque way to mark Holocaust Memorial Day, January 27th, by announcing an explicitly racist and xenophobic policy.
And by vetted, you mean that they go through a rigorous examination, and they always have. It's not just
right.
It's not just because they are Syrian and we're in the middle of this conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Any refugee has always been seriously and rigorously vetted.
That's correct, especially in recent decades, and especially in the last 20 years, refugees coming from the Middle East.
So that takes time.
It takes 3 to 5 years. You'll often hear it takes 18 to 24 months. It actually takes longer than that.
So given the nature of this crisis, the enormity of it, how would that help? They would be stuck in refugee camps for half a decade.
Exactly. And again, I'll direct your listeners to the article by Natasha Hall, where she talks about some specific examples of people who have been directly hurt. And this is also true, by the way, of refugees from Central America in recent years. Mm-hmm. And I've been involved, too, in advocacy efforts on behalf of Central Americans. And many people have been deported back, including by Obama, and then actually were killed in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and other places.
I want to go back to something that you've alleged, and other people have said this, too, that these people, these refugees, are not terrorists,
mm-hmm.
But they are fleeing both the Assad regime and ISIS. How can those who are afraid, particularly of letting ISIS sympathizers into the country, despite the fact that they're refugees, mm-hmm. what do you say to them to convince them that these people are not going to come in here and commit terrorist acts?
Sure, and I understand that fear that people have. It's a fear based on a number of things, but I would say, for one thing, to look at a couple facts. One of them is that when something does happen that someone claims they were inspired by ISIS, this is not someone who waited 3 to 5 years to come into the country, and that's not how ISIS would attempt to send someone into this country.
And in fact, I would think that if they were ISIS sympathizers, mm-hmm. they'd stay and fight for ISIS, wouldn't they?
Well, that too, or someone here who was a demented or deranged or violent person or criminal person for whatever reason learns about ISIS and then commits an act and then claims that they did it for ISIS, like Omar Martin in Orlando, who knew less about Islam than just about anybody on the face of the earth. But I'd also acquaint people who have this concern with some facts. According to a report from the Cato Institute, out of millions of refugees resettled to the United States over several decades, just 20 of them have committed or attempted attacks. These were all in the 70s before the creation of the modern screening process. The annual chance of being killed in a terrorist attack committed by a refugee is 1 in 3.6 billion.
We have to take a break. I have one more question for you before we meet our Syrian refugee in just a moment or two, and we'll get to that when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the farm at Dover Vineyards. With funding from Got to Be NC, the Vineyard is hosting an open house Saturday, April 29th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. with a Villard Blanc wine tasting and party at 4. Details at thefarmatdovervineyards.com. And the Iron Yard, offering full and part-time web development courses in Charlotte for career development. Enrollment is open. More at theironyard.com/Charlotte. It's tax day. the deadline for Americans to file their tax returns. Meanwhile, Congress is still waiting to hear the Trump administration's plans for overhauling the tax code. And there are new calls for the president to make his returns public. Those are just some of the things they'll be talking about on Point with Tom Ashbrook coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back.
All Things Considered on WFAE helps you go beneath the surface of the day's news.
Pointed out that the report is not a cure-all or quick fix. She says a lot of obstacles, such as segregated neighborhoods, were intentional decisions made hundreds of years ago that will take a long time to fix.
There's more to every story. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Charles Kurtzman is with us. He's professor of sociology at UNC Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations, along with Dr. John Cox, associate professor of international studies at UNC Charlotte's Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies. There are events through the day today, but at 6:30 tonight, our next guest will be speaking along with another Syrian refugee as part of the Witness in Residence initiative at UNC Charlotte Center City, and we have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Before I introduce our next guest, Dr. Cox, how many other Middle Eastern countries and how many people from Syria, the refugees from Syria, have been settled and accepted by other Middle Eastern countries?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. More than half of them, well, actually more than two-thirds of them, roughly 4 million, to the shame of the wealthy regime such as Saudi Arabia, also a regime with a horrible human rights record that we don't hear so much about in this country because of Uncle Sam's cozy relationship with Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabians and various other oil-rich kingdoms have accepted zero refugees. So as I said earlier, more than 600,000 are in Jordan, a small country. More than 1 million are in Lebanon, a small and poor country. More than 2 million are in Turkey, a larger country. But again, that's a large large number of people. And again, only roughly 10,000 in the United States.
I'm going to bring in somebody who knows this intimately because he is a Syrian. Among the panelists tonight at this event is our next guest, Zubair Rushk. Rushk, I'm not going to say your name right ever. Zubair Rushk, a Syrian refugee. He left the country prior to the start of hostilities in 2005 and sought asylum in Lebanon. He came to this country through the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program in 2010. He is now a U.S. citizen. Congratulations, I guess.
Thank you.
And a student at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr.
You left Syria in 2005. Why? This is before the conflict.
Yes, way
started.
Before the conflict. I'm from a minority groups called Kurd. Because we are a Kurd, we get violent by regime to not able to speak our own language, to not able to practice our culture, not able to talk in the street about using our own language in
Why?
School.
Why was that a threat?
So in 1963, when regimes, when Ba'ath Party get control of 63, when the Ba'ath get control of Syria, they changed name of the Syria from Syrian Republican Syrian Republican, which is make whole Syrian as one block. That's all they have. Only one kind of group, which Arab other groups Syrian and a Kurd and Armenian all considered as a Arab. So, and in the same times, many Kurd who was living in the region for 1,000 years, they take their nationality and they become a refugee in Syria, didn't have any rights. I get my citizenship through my family, but I consider as an Arab from Syria, not as a Kurd minority group.
So as a Kurd, you could not practice your culture, you could not teach your culture, you could not speak your language in Syria. And so you, after getting a degree, I believe, in electronic engineering from Aleppo, a university in Aleppo, you decided to open a school in your home for Kurdish children to teach them their language, to teach them their customs and their history. How long did that last before they shut you down?
So it's illegal school. I open it in my home. I bring books through smuggle from Turkey, from Lebanon, from Iraq. Use all funding my school, using my own money. It's just locked for 3 months when they send undercover people who speak my identity and come to my home at
So the Assad regime sent in people who spoke Kurdish.
Yes.
Posed as Kurdish.
Yes.
People and essentially interrogated you without your knowledge, and then they arrested you.
Yes.
And you were in jail for how long?
For 7 months.
And they released you. Why did they release you?
So they released me because they make me in the 7 months that I lose my memory at all. So I 85% of my memory gone.
Because of torture?
Torture.
What did they do to you?
So one of the things that make me lose my memory was called dark rooms torturing, when you have to sit in the chair that's not able to move yourself, and your head will be locked and small drop of water will come to your head. Couple hours you will count. Mm-hmm. Start counting the drop of water will hit you. After a couple hours, you will feel like one of drops become like a hammer hitting you, your head, and you start numbing. And then I find myself in the cell that I am not able to speak, not able to see, and don't know anyone in the same cell that I'm in.
And this went on for 7 months?
For 7 months. That's this kind of torturing happened exactly 2 weeks before I get my freedom. So they know at that time I will not change nothing in the.
So they gave you your freedom, but then you were told that to report back to the military court to be charged for dangers to state security, and your lawyer told you to leave the country.
Yes.
Because if you went back, they would detain you for years, essentially. So you went to Lebanon. How difficult was that? How did you get out of the country? How did you get into Lebanon?
So, yeah. So in Syria, the system of courting is two systems when you do any crime related to the politics. First one, you have to attend the political court, which they supposed to charge me for 7 months. Mm-hmm. And then I left. After that, they sent me to military court, which is charged for this kind of security, dangerous to security, between 5 to 10 years, according to my lawyer who's giving me advice. And he said it's not possible. So at that time, I could not function. I cannot not talk as much as possible because of the PTSD I have and losing of memory. So they advised my family to take me out. For 16 hours, my brother and my cousin drive me through whole back road in Syria to get to the border between Lebanon and Syria, and they pay $200 to smugglers who will make me ride the donkey to cross the mountain. And smuggle always lie.
So you left the country legally, obviously, got into Lebanon. You're suffering from PTSD.
Yes.
You've lost your memory.
Yes.
How did you function?
So I went, my brother was waiting me, and he in the part of advising that I get through my brothers to go to the United Nations Register to able to send me through them to one restart facility that help prisoner to back to function again. So for the next 3 years, I was working with UN and with a rehabilitation place called Restart to rebuild my memory and functioning again.
And in that same period of time, in that five-year period between 2005 and when you arrived here in 2010, you also applied to come to this country as a refugee, and you were one of the people who successfully made that. We were given permission to come here. Why did they choose you? There's so many people that are trying to get in.
Yes. Between 2005 to 2010, there are only 20 people who's a Syrian living in Lebanon illegally and registered at United Nations and accepted as a refugee status. So first 3 years, I get my status of a refugee, and then I transferring for 1 year to IOM organization, international organization for immigrant, which they do a lot of interview, background check, and medical exam to be accepted in all the details.
What was the vetting process like on the part of the United States to come here? What did they? What was the process? What did they do? What did they ask you?
Okay, so they ask all details about your life and through UN. And in the first 3 years when I arrived to Lebanon, when I go to the went to the rehabilitation place and going back to UN, I did around 10 interview. I cannot make sure exactly how many interview I did, between 5 to 10, because I wasn't stable at that time, not remembering too much at that time due to the PTSD. They asked me all details about my life from the day I born, and they know all details in the region that I came from. So they know about all kind of party, what charge they get it if you did a certain kind of crime, political crime. So they know, they very knowledge people who's interviewing you about all details in your life. Then after you get your UN or refugee status, you transfer to different organization related to UN, which is called International Organization for Immigrants. Then this one, they will do a couple interview with you related to your life in Lebanon and related to what you believe in religion, what you believe in life, and all details about the crime. That if you accept it with these two organizations, then after 4 years, you will send it to U.S. Embassy to make interview with U.S. Embassy. Before you go into U.S. Embassy, you have to do again medical exam, and you have to do eye screen, and you have to do fingerprint, all those details. Then you went to U.S., you will make your interview for 12 hours from morning to the evening. They will ask you all details, all document you have, all files. That so you get file with book of 600 files.
Yeah, you're showing me a stack of papers.
Yeah,
it's about
a foot
tall.
With you, and they know all details about your life. And then they will ask you to wait for until receiving call from them.
Now, you went through all of this. Eventually, they said, you're welcome to come.
Yes.
They gave you a visa.
Yes,
you
after came, 18 months.
After 18 months. You eventually, I think you came into the country through Los Angeles and went into the Northeast and then eventually settled in Durham, North Carolina. And you came here, as I understand it, speaking no English.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
They put you up, they give you a place to live and pay the rent for a month. And by the end of the month, you have to have a job or you can't live here. I mean, you can't support yourself. What is that like? You don't speak English. You don't know the country. You don't know where you are. And you have to make a living.
Yes.
How difficult?
It's very difficult. I did not know anyone in United States. No one know me exactly. So the resettlement agency come pick me from airport and put me to the house, which have only one chair and one bed. That was very good for me. And after 2 days, they came with bad news. They thought it's very bad news that they only able to pay my rent because I was a single for only 1 month and I have to start work immediately.
You worked as a dishwasher at Cheesecake Factory.
Yeah. That's my second job.
What was the first job?
The first job I work as a housekeeper in Comfort Hotel, but they fired me after 1 week. They say you are because I had a polio, so they could not could not be fast enough. So
fast enough. We're running out of time, so I want to make sure that people understand that you are now, although you already have a degree, you're back at UNC in Chapel Hill getting yet another degree, and I think this is in global peace. I'm trying to find it in my
Global
notes.
Study and Peace, War, and Defense.
Which is, I think is interesting. And just prior to the president's executive order being issued, you were were able to bring in your wife. You had married a woman before you left.
No, 2013, I went to Turkey to meet her, and we get married in 2013. But 5 months ago, I was finally able to make her enter into the U.S. with really after.
And what has her transition been like?
Today, she's suffering. She has a very kind stage of PTSD, and she even refused to go to the psychiatrist. It's very hard.
And she has PTSD because?
She went through 3 big battles against ISIS. So she was a student at Deir Zor when ISIS captured Deir Zor, and she has to escape from there to Al-Hasakah city. And then back again to school, which after 1 year, 2015, ISIS again break the wall and enter to the Hasakah, captured Hasakah. So it's
How many people in you have a pretty large family, I understand. How many of them are still in Syria? How many of them are directly affected by the violence and destruction?
So whole my family get affected by it. I am here. My other brother living in Lebanon. One of my brother left whole his family, and he living in Sweden because ISIS tried to capture him for kidnapping him for money. So he left his family, and then they tried to capture his little daughter, and then he left the city and took her her kids to the village and escaped to Sweden through the Turkey.
As a child, could you have imagined this was going to be your life?
No, at all.
What do you hope for your life now that you're out of all of that? And I know you still have family there, so that's very concerning, I'm certain. But what are your hopes now that your wife is here and you're an American citizen? What are your hopes for your life going forward?
So my hope that my children will feel proud to be a U.S. citizen like me too, like me in the first 5 years when I came here. 5 years I was feeling belonging to this country. I feeling like I'm a part of the country and this country give me whatever. But the recent years and the racism and against the refugee and Syrian, it just break my heart. And I feel like I'm kind of not belonging to this country as I used to be in Syria too.
Zubair Rushk is a Syrian refugee, now a student at UNC Chapel Hill, an American citizen. Dr. John Cox and Dr. Charles Kurtzman, thank you all for the